Good morning. Happy NBA draft day.
Good morning. Happy NBA draft day.
Blue Jays also won. That's
happy
good.
Happy Max Scherzer day to you.
Happy Mad Max day. Yeah, let's go. What a day it is. It's also to bridge the gap between our show and the Jays game and the draft tonight. Jacob Mizorewski against Paul Skeens at 2 in the afternoon.
Yep. It's a full day. And there's a lot going on. And I have to say, just right off the top, it needs to be said, you are a hero. The amount of stuff that you are doing today across two sports, Blake Murphy, it's really impressive and it deserves to be recognized. So thank you for your hard work.
Let's see if the show goes better than yesterday's for me before we pat me on the back. But yes, as a programming note, so the Jays game is at 6:40 tonight. It will air as usual. Blair and Barker will do Jays Talk postgame. And once that concludes, I will do the Raptor show breaking down. I think that'll be like mid-draft still at that point. Mm. But if the Raptors keep the number 9 pick, we'll be breaking that down and kind of kicking around everything else that happens. Tonight's the first round of the draft. Tomorrow is the second round of the draft. You will be without me tomorrow.
That's
Show
right.
Ali will be here. Not because I don't want to be here and not because I won't have an eye on Mad Max, but... I will be focused on the draft since I'm doing a live draft show.
Also, you deserve a bit of a break. It's
not even really, though, because the draft is tomorrow, too. Like, I'm still going to be working. I won't get a chance to watch the Jays game in full.
Yeah.
So me doing I would have to pretend tomorrow on the show.
Hey, which I've been doing it for like 4 years now. So.
That's not true. So that's a programming note. Quick standing. So the Blue Jays won yesterday, and the Yankees lost. The Mets lost. Only one good thing happened in New York, and it had nothing to do with baseball. So that's a small positive, for a pretty big positive for the city, but not for these cities' sports teams. The Blue Jays gap in the AL East is now down to 2.5 games, and of course, notable that they beat the Cleveland Guardians, who are currently in the last spot out of a wild card. So the Jays now have a 2.5 game cushion on that as well. This is obviously a fairly big series and a fairly big 10 days. And it got off to a good start with a 10-6 victory. It was not the least stressful 10-6 victory that you could possibly imagine. Before we get into the specifics of that, also not the least stressful Bark at the Park day. Those dogs looked very warm.
Yeah, they looked so stressed. That really did break my heart. And it was funny because I was watching the game at my friend's place, and she is a dog trainer. That is, if she works at the Humane Society, that's kind of what she does. And I'm like, okay, am I reading the body language wrong here? What's going on? She's like, no, these dogs are extremely stressed. Guys, Bark at the Park is fun, but if it's a humid day, if it's an overly hot day, I would say that even the team should probably say, you know what, we're going to postpone this. It's not healthy. It's not safe for the little creatures. But there they were. I mean, obviously, they survived, right? It's not that big of a deal, but my heart broke for those little fellas.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
My heart broke for you too, because you were also without power, without AC, without anything, any of those things yesterday.
I was, the entire audience now knows exactly where I live from a couple of botches on my part last week. I was in that big city power outage. So I had no power from like 6 o'clock until sometime in the middle of the night. Which was, luckily we live in a technological era where, I guess I could have always just like turned the game on the radio, but you can't see. I like listening to games on the radio.
Yeah.
I like our radio broadcast crew, but for the purposes of doing this show, I like the visual, to be able to break stuff down, I want the visual a little bit more. But thankfully I could just watch it on my phone.
Right.
Thanks
on.
To the run.
Burning through your data.
My beautiful Rogers phone plan and Rogers Xfinity or whatever the app is called.
Yeah.
So I was able to, while sweaty and while grumpy, because I had to throw out all my food and things like that because the power was out for so long. The Jays win 10-6. Nobody cares about how I enjoyed that game or did not enjoy that game. They might care about what I didn't enjoy from the game, which was once again, Chad Green, not to pick on him because he wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
Who had a rough one, but where do you want to start? I think we start with the bullpen that nearly blew it, and then we can round back to George Springer's heroics.
Yeah, listen, we started with the bad stuff anyway, power outage, stressed out doggies. Let's just power through the bad stuff, and then we can close on a high note this first segment and talk about everything that did go right, namely George Springer and Eric Lauer for the Blue Jays. Yeah, so the bullpen, that's a good place to start. I know that we have been sort of talking about Chad Green for a little bit here because it is a problem. He is the reliever who has allowed the most home runs in the entire league this year. Second place is Jeff Hoffman, which is also pretty concerning if you are a Blue Jays fan. But you're right in saying that it wasn't just him yesterday. And when it's a humid day, when it's as hot as it was, both teams combined for 12 walks, it's clear that there was something that was not going right, and that pitchers were struggling a little bit to maybe get a grip on the ball and things of those.
Yeah, we saw Eric Lauer with a lot of the rosin, a lot of the pant leg.
Right, and so command right there just becomes harder. Still, it wasn't exclusive to yesterday, and it has become a little bit of a concern for the Blue Jays. Preceding Chad Green coming into the game and allowing that three-run home run, was it three-run? Yeah, it was a three-run mm-hmm. home run, was Mason Fluharty, who has also not had the best stretch up to this point. And we have spoken a little bit about bullpen depth of late, and I think that this is what you meant by that, right? Is
yeah.
that Mason Fluharty had a good start to the season, and now we're kind of seeing the regression that was expected.
Yeah, and this is not to pick on Mason Fluharty. He's a rookie reliever. Yeah. You're going to have some ups and downs. Show me the relievers in baseball who didn't, you know, at some point struggle or have to get moved to low leverage or even go back down to AAA at some point. But he's got an 8-10 ERA since mid-May when we were kind of like, holy, right. look at this. You know, hit not only a scoreless streak he was on a hitless streak for a good chunk. So 8-10 ERA since mid-May. That's a little rough. You know, he's a guy that while they don't have a lot of lefty in the bullpen right now, given that Nick Sandlin is a platoon neutral guy because of the splitter, as guys come back, Mason Fluharty does have options available. Braden Fisher has options as well, but has pitched a little better. So I could see him getting a reprieve at some point. The Chad Green one is tougher mm-hmm. because the Blue Jays front office gave him a 3-year, $23.5 million deal with all those weird, if we opt out, you can opt in. If you opt out, we can opt in kind of options. And I didn't love the deal at the time. A career kind of setup man with good, not elite numbers who had seen a velocity dip and was coming off major elbow surgery. And now you're at a point where it's one thing to designate Eric Swanson for assignment after, you know, you worked out a 1-year contract with him to avoid arbitration and paid him $3 million. That's not the outcome anyone really wanted, but that's $3 million. Chad Green's making $10.5 million this year. I know you can't do the whole sunk cost thing. I do think that probably gives him a little bit more leash than the performance would, just in terms of, you know, obviously they invested in this guy and believed in him a certain amount. But in addition to the home runs, just nothing under the hood looks that good right now. The velocity is down even from last year. The pitch design metrics don't like him as much as prior years. He doesn't walk anyone, at least. But you see yesterday, and maybe some of this is the conditions, but the difference between control and command, right, is he gets a gift against Lane Thomas. Throws a slider way out of the zone, gets called for a strike. So he's up 0-1 and then misses a spot with a slider and then comes just all the way in the zone. And like middle hangs it to Lane Thomas. Yeah. So, you know, and that's even after getting a gift well off the outside of the plate. So some of the command stuff isn't there. You look under the hood, he still gets a decent amount of chase outside of the zone, but nobody swings and misses against him. He has arguably the worst exit velocities and hard hit rates of any pitcher in baseball, which is not surprising when you see the home run totals. So there's just, he's not really tricking anyone right now. And it's tough when you give up that quality of contact. You got to miss a lot of bats. Yeah. Like, it'd be one thing if Brendan Little were giving up that kind of contact, because, or Jeff Hoffman, who's right behind him. We have more faith that Jeff Hoffman's going to turn that around because he's missing a lot of bats on the path to doing that. It's tough if you're also not missing bats.
Yeah, listen, at that point, it was a fairly comfortable game still, and it became a little more comfortable after that. But what was it, 6-1 up to mm-hmm. at that point? Sure. You know, you want to save your high leverage arms, as you should. This is an important stretch. We don't know what we're going to get from Max Scherzer. But still, the fact that a reliever with these numbers is getting a chance to pitch with inherited runners, to me, does not make any sense. You know what I mean? You could argue that it would have been better to just leave Fluharty in there. And I don't know where his pitch count was at that point.
And it was left, I don't know, it's Lane Thomas in there, so maybe the handedness plays a factor.
For sure it does. But, you know, that's what we've seen from Chad Green a lot this year. And so, yeah, I don't know why you would permit him to inherit runners at that point in the game. It worked out for the Blue Jays, that needs to be said, but it was not.
I mean, it worked out, but like,
not because it didn't, not because really.
Yeah, like if look at the cascading effect that had too, right? Where thankfully George Springer comes through with that home run, but that's a day where you end up like Eric Lauer, who is your shortest guy in the rotation, gives you 5 1/3, and you still have to use 5 bullpen arms,
including Yariel Rodriguez,
the day before Max Scherzer is coming off the IL, and we've heard 80 to 85 pitches, but you don't know 1,000% how he's going to look. So they have to burn 5 relievers in that one. And like, if you backtrack at all, you probably could have sent Braden Fisher out for another one. Mm-hmm. He only threw what, 7 pitches?
Yeah.
To get those 2 outs to clean up the 6th.
I was sure that he was going to come back out.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe it's because they see him as a potential multi-inning option mm-hmm. today if Scherzer goes short or something like that. I think they're still figuring out how to use Braden Fisher, where like sometimes it looks like he's a low leverage length guy, sometimes it looks like he's sniffing leverage.
Yeah.
He's an interesting one right now. Obviously, when Jimmy Garcia and Ryan Burback, he'll go back down to a more rookie role, but he's been really good. So
he has been, yeah. And maybe part of it is just like figuring out where exactly in the order you want him to pitch mm-hmm. and where and against what guys you feel comfortable letting Braden Fisher pitch. But he's proven himself at this point.
So and certainly more than some of the other options.
Yeah, and like that, again, we expect this to regress a little bit. It is. He does have the benefit, I guess, of being a rookie and not having been around for too long. Guys are seeing him for the first time. All of that does play a factor in the same way that it did with Mason Fluharty early in the season. That's mm-hmm. It's part of it, right? But I was sure that he was coming back out just because of where the game was and what the Blue Jays situation is for today with Max Scherzer.
And that's you know, where it gets more, like, obviously they won this game, and in another scenario, Chad Green coming in that spot, if you're going to have Chad Green in your bullpen, that's probably a spot you need to be comfortable using him in. I looked this up. I triple checked it because I thought I was wrong. Coming into that game, he'd only allowed 3 inherited runners to score this year.
Oh, yeah.
The number feels much higher.
It does indeed. Yeah.
So now he's allowed 5 of 15, which isn't a great rate, but coming in this one is 3 of 13. Anyway, so you have to use Paxton Schultz, which he was definitely, maybe he's the corresponding move for Scherzer, so you didn't mind burning him. But again, five guys used, you lose an arm out of the bullpen today because Max Scherzer's coming back. You at least didn't have to use Spencer Turnbull, so I'd imagine Turnbull's ready to go for length behind it. Anyway, there's a rolling effect to all of this. John Schneider kind of used the not excuse after the game, but the context of they've been running a lot of bullpen days, so guys have been used a little bit more. That's kind of true, but they're only 8th in relief innings used, and like that includes the, you know, if Eric Lauer goes 4 in bulk out of the bullpen as a follower, that's included in relief innings. So they're like top 10, but only slightly above average. I think they just,
this isn't the Dodgers we're talking about.
Like
basically,
they need Jimmy Garcia and Ryan Burback is how you evaluate this bullpen, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
By the way, before we move on to the Springer side, Jimmy Garcia, we got an update yesterday. So he pitched in an FCL game on Monday. He is going to throw with Dunedin on Thursday. If all goes well, Buffalo on the weekend, and then we'll see where he's at after that. Ryan Burr got into his 3rd rehab appearance last night with Buffalo, threw an inning with a walk, 13 pitches. Not sure how many more, given that he had a setback last time, not sure how long they're gonna have him go down there. But both of those guys seem, I mean, once you're up to AAA on a rehab assignment, you're close-ish.
Yeah, for sure.
So that'll be, that's something worth tracking there. Oh,
certainly good news.
Yeah, while I'm doing injury updates, this is not related to what we were talking about, but Dalton Varsho had a minor setback yesterday, per Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, who's going to join us in a little bit. He felt some tightness while running, so he's still hitting and catching, but they're slowing down the running progression for the time being, and see where he's at. So that wasn't
devastating.
Yeah.
Devastating.
Okay. We will talk to Arden Zwelling about some more of those updates and Max Scherzer's return tonight. We'll also talk some Andrés Giménez. Paul Spohr is going to join us later in the show, and then Doug Fox will come on. He had a great newsletter talking to Joe Sclafani, the Jays director of player development. So he'll come on with us a little bit later. So all of that bullpen stuff creates a more dramatic game than maybe we thought. They're up 6-1.
Yeah.
This is, you're cruising. You
Eric
can use
Lauer
some,
was chucking.
Yeah. 5 1/3 for his words.
His words.
He's okay. Sorry, George Springer. I'm going to bump you for a second again. Because let's just do Eric Lauer, I'm beyond just the results, I'm finding it so enjoyable right now. So last night, he's a local guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's got 50 to 60 people in the stands. He's telling stories about CC Sabathia was his favorite. He modeled his mechanics after Cliff Lee, which is which is really cool to hear. And then, yeah, he says stuff like, hey, did you know your velocity was up? Oh, I didn't realize. Nah. I couldn't find the velocity reading. I was just up there chucking. He gets asked about third time through. He's like, that's why I love pitching.
Yeah.
He seems like he's having a really good time. And how could you not, given where his career went and the move over to Korea and the success he's seen early on here?
Yeah. Also, just a smart guy to talk to. He always has something to say that adds to, let's say, what we're doing here or to a story that's being written or whatever it may be. It's enjoyable to talk to him in that sense too, because it's so clear that he is thinking through the things that he is doing, where he wants to go, what this team expects of him, and it's just so clear, right, when you talk to him. So yeah, that's been a really good story for the Blue Jays. There's been a few of those on the pitching side for the Blue Jays this season, and maybe that's not something that we came in expecting.
Maybe we get another one tonight.
Maybe we do. That would be awesome. But with Lauer specifically, this was a very different game plan than what we had seen from him up to this point, which honestly just adds to the greatness of this moment for him, right?
Yeah, it was the most breaking balls he's thrown in a game since 2022. So we had talked after his last start, Chris Black had that great thread about the fastball up in the zone, and he's dotting it up there, and he's kind of keeping guys off balance for, yeah, contact, but contact into the deep parts of the park and in the air and not the hardest contact and things like that. And then he comes into this one, and maybe it's because the Guardians are a smart team and he expected them to be on the fastball because they're usually a pretty, you know, smart scouting team and things like that. I quickly looked up the numbers yesterday on the show, and the Guardians had not done super well against medium speed lefty fastballs up in the zone, but it was a small sample. So maybe they saw something in the Guardians. Maybe he just wanted to stay one chess move ahead.
Right.
But to go from everything had been about the fastball and dotting it up in the zone to, you know what? Here's my most breaker heavy game since, you know, a couple teams and a couple countries ago. I thought was a fascinating twister. Of course, Carlos Santana got to him for one.
Of course.
It's at least it wasn't Daniel Schneeman anymore. At least it was back to being Carlos Santana and Stephen Kwan, which is, you know, that seems inevitable now too.
Yeah.
But yeah, fun Eric Lauer stuff.
It was. And it was also interesting to sort of see that the pitch that was set aside a little bit was the cutter, which had also been very, very good for Lauer up to this point, and you know, didn't throw it as much. I wasn't there. I wasn't able to ask about it, but I did think it was pretty curious that that was the one that took a step back so that the curveball could mm-hmm. shine some more. But yeah, I still believe that the fastball up in the zone is where it all starts, and that works for, you know, if you're trying to play that off of the curve or the curveball off of that as well. And then the slider, which he threw a little bit more than usual as well, and it was so clear that the Guardians were not expecting it, or they didn't know what to do with it, because they're two very different breaking balls.
Yeah, probably the best indicator, like obviously with breaking balls, the big thing we care about is swing and miss. Mm-hmm. Those are your miss pitches. He stole 9 called strikes with his breaking balls yesterday.
Yeah, that's pretty telling.
I wasn't looking for this.
Exactly. Yeah, so to your point, if you're trying to stay one chess move ahead, there you go. You did it. And it goes back to the fact that when you talk to Eric Lauer, it is very, very evident that he knows what he's trying to do, and he knows how to stay one step ahead of opponents. Obviously, that's not just on him. This is a combined effort. Pete Walker is involved in that. Alejandro Kirk is involved with that. But really, anything that the Blue Jays have asked of Eric Lauer, he has delivered time and time again, no matter how he has to get there.
So, how good has the Jays offense been the last couple months? Well, they scored 10 runs last night, and we just talked about the pitchers for 15 minutes. So that is notable. The bat's clicking a little bit. Bobichek gets it started immediately with a single, then scores on an Ernie Clement double. Ernie Clement's first time hitting second this year. He had 2 hits last night. His OPS is up to 769. Chris Black texted me this morning with the note that Ernie Clement is on pace for a 5-win season right now, which has only happened 16 times in Blue Jays history.
Yeah. What do you think about the All-Star push?
I mean, third base is a weak position.
Yeah.
It's probably going to come down to, like, I hate doing this because it's not really the way you want to answer the question, but because every team has to have an All-Star representative, so much of it is going to come down to, well, like, do the Jays get multiple starters in? And then, like, I think Kirk is the safest. If there's going to be a bench, a reserve, who is a Blue Jay, I think Alejandro Kirk makes the most sense. Sure. And then from there, it's like, does Ernie get bumped because, you know, Vlad won the vote and Kirk's already in there? And then, you know, there's not room for a third J because you've got to make sure there's somehow a Chicago White Sox and stuff like that. We'll see. But I think when your OPS is up north of 750 and you're playing premium defense at multiple positions, and he even stole base yesterday.
I know. It was funny to, you know, just read his postgame comments as well, because he kind of knows that he got lucky in a few, that he's been getting lucky.
And he's being a little self-deprecating with some of the contact stuff.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, that's how it goes. He is hitting the ball hard, and he's doing, you know, what he's good at. He is very good at it, and he's doing it consistently. But it's also nice to see a guy just, you know, be a little tongue-in-cheek about that stuff. Yeah. And yeah, well, when you put the ball in play, good things happen. That's what we keep hearing. So a little bit of luck is just part of it.
Yeah, so he had a pair of hits. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. had a pair of hits. Alejandro Kirk had a pair of hits. And there was also Miles Straw, like, probably should have had a pair of hits, but they called that triple a three-base error.
Yeah.
Look, that was a circus for Rodriguez. He also had some bad base running. Just not a good Rodriguez game.
Yep.
I don't know. That's you're trying to help out your pitcher with that scoring decision as the hometown scorers, I think. But so all those guys, good offensive days. And then there is George Springer,
right,
who had a three-hit day, including the big grand slam in the eighth inning. So at that point, the Blue Jays had turned a 6-1 lead into a 6-4 lead. It turned out that the Guardians would add two more, so the Jays needed some sort of insurance there. Fun inning.
Yep.
And yeah, so it's interesting with Springer, where he had, obviously was the hottest hitter on the team. He was the only guy hitting early in the season. Cooled off a little bit in May, but still pretty solid, and had been having a chilly June. And then comes through with three hits yesterday, including the biggest one in recent memory with that grand slam. Pretty fun.
It was fun. He was so fired up. You could so clearly see how much he was enjoying that.
Great picture from Ollie Kahn on the Blue Jays social media, not only of Springer celebrating on his way to first base, but you can see the pitcher just dying on the mound behind. Hunter Gattis.
Tough.
Yeah. You could just see him dying on the mound behind Springer's celebration. Great picture from Ollie Kahn.
Here's one thing that stood out to me, and I wish we'd had time to chat a little bit before the show. It happens. Maybe that's something that we can revisit on Friday or whatever. But the bat speed for Springer, which is not something that we have, you know, that's really stood out throughout the season. I think he's right there. He's average when it comes to bat speed. But
68th percentile.
Right. Which is good, not great type of thing, right? But yesterday, that is what was on display, including in the home run, where he was swinging the bat. And you know, clearly he kind of knew it was coming there. He knew it was a mistake pitch, 94 middle, did not miss, swung for the fences, watched it go. But the one thing that stood out to me beyond even that at bat, there were other at bats as well, was the bat speed. And it was, you know, hitting elite levels, which is not something that we have seen from Springer all that often. Most of, you know, the good contact or the good offensive production that has happened for Springer has come more or less with just an average swing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, the bat speed is up a little bit this year over last year. And I think the biggest thing with that is his fast swing rate. So how often does he get to that A swing?
Yes.
That's what's really improved. And I think this goes back to early in the year when maybe it wasn't maybe we weren't entirely being fair, but the word, you know, cheating got used a little bit. Not actually cheating, but when we say that, you know, looking for a fastball, and if it's, we saw some, when he was red hot early in the season, we saw some big swings that connected, and we saw some big whiffs.
Yep.
And like out of his shoes whiffs sometimes. So we, you know, in talking to some of the guys who analyze the swings a little better, the guys and girls who analyze the swings a little better around the Blue Jays, you know, one of the guesses was, well, he know he's lost a little bit, so maybe he's, you know, guessing and jumping early, and that's going to mean when he makes contact, it's great.
Yep.
And when he guesses wrong, it looks bad. Yeah. And we've seen that. His strikeout rate's up for the season. But I think most importantly is that fast swing rate tells me, even like, and that doesn't mean contact only. You can fast swing and miss.
Mm-hmm.
But that tells me he's better identifying when he can get to his best swing.
Right.
So even if the overall bat speed is, you know, what I say, 68th percentile, so above average, but nothing crazy. Like, certainly not looking like Vlad and Barger or anything like that. The fact that he is getting to a good swing much more often than last year, I care about that more than I care about, like, the average bat speed.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, if he swung exactly his average every time, that is not as meaningful to me. Like, Sure, Luis Arraez probably does that, but it's more to me about getting that, what do they call it, the A swing. Mm-hmm. More about getting that big swing off a little more often.
Yeah, it's cool to see that, if that is the case, right? And what did you say, you had 3 hits yesterday?
Yeah.
And if you go back and you see that all 3 hits, or I don't know, 3 out of 4 or 5 plate appearances, that is marked as a fast swing, then yeah, that's exactly it. It means that he's seeing it very, very well.
Three of them, his homer, one of his singles, and a ground out were fast swings. The other were. It's so funny to look at the bat speed list after every game, where it's always just Barcher didn't play yesterday, but it's always just Vlad and Barcher at the top, no matter what.
Yeah, that is pretty. And it's honestly, I don't look at that as much, just because you kind of expect that to be the case. But it did kind of, you know, catch my eye. And it does mean probably that in a game like yesterday, Springer was pretty locked in. He was seeing the ball very well, and he knew when it was time to get that ace swing off. That's what those numbers kind of show me.
Yeah, and it was also just the maybe less so the home run, but throughout the game, especially when he was battling with Logan Allen, there seemed to be an interesting, like, when we talk about him guessing right or being right on a pitch or something, how he thinks through these plate appearances, especially as the game goes on a little later. So the first at bat, he grounded out. He got jammed inside with a bunch of fastballs and cutters. And then second at bat, he's ready for it a little bit. He didn't make the best contact with it, but he inside outs a cutter in on the hands. And then third at bat, he grounds out. And Allen has changed at this point. He's low away. But then so even though the pitcher changed, you kind of know what the book is going to be. And so he gets Colby Allard, and they're setting him up for that outside away, and he's able to get it for a single. And then Gattis just kind of missed. But you did see, Joe Siddle broke it down pretty well, where you could tell what Gattis was trying to set him up for the first couple pitches. And then Joe Siddle thought when George Springer gave that bad, that really awkward swing on the changeup, he was going to get another one. Mm-hmm. But Springer was instead like, I'm going to keep looking for the fastball. If he throws me a changeup, awkward swing, whatever. And Gattis threw him a really bad one. So I don't know. I like the kind of in-plate appearance adjustments from Springer. And when we talk about what he's looking for and what he's jumping on, you can kind of trace back through the games that he has a good game. You can kind of trace back through, okay, this happened a little earlier. You can see maybe what he was looking for. You know, Joe Siddle and Caleb Joseph are so good at their jobs, because they'll like sit there and be like, pitcher's going to throw this. Mm-hmm. Or like, if I'm the hitter, I'm sitting on this. So it's fascinating when like that Gattis one plays out and Gattis disagrees with Joe Siddle and pays for it.
Yeah.
I thought that was, I thought that was amusing. Yeah.
Joe Siddle. That is definitely the takeaway here. Yeah. Good stuff. The broadcast does make us smarter every single night, which is a privilege.
Yes. A couple bullet points here before you talk to Arden Zwelling. Yes, they got out on the contact play yet again. That's 3 in the last 2 games. Other than that, though, one of the best defensive and base running games you're going to see. A lot of first to third, a lot of aggression on the bases. Andrés Giménez, obviously, with that ridiculous play. There was a really unconventional double play they turned. Really good defensive base running game, in addition to the bats going. Jonathan Clase also had a funny game where John Schneider, I guess it's Jonathan Schneider also, said after the game that he's getting more and more comfortable at the plate. He had a couple hits, some good base running. There was also a moment, I don't know if you caught this on the broadcast, where everyone was trying to get his attention when he was in right field, because I guess he was positioned incorrectly. And like the bench is trying to get his attention, and then Vlad's trying to get his attention. Luckily, the ball didn't get hit there, but kind of a little bit of everything from Jonathan Clase in that one.
You can see the youth right there.
Yeah.
When it's good, it's really good, and you can see the potential. And then sometimes it's like, yeah, you still have some learning to do, which is why he's here. It's fine. It's, the Blue Jays are still managing to win games with Jonathan Clase contributing at that. And so, yeah, you kind of just hope that he can work on the maturity level a little bit. The caught stealing was also pretty funny, that delayed steal that he attempted there.
Yeah.
Who knows if that was by design at that point, but
it did not
work out.
The other note I wanted to, before you take a break here, David Schneider did go 0-for-3, but he had a very big walk in the 7th inning that kind of kept that rally going and led to some runs. He also got hosed really badly on a third strike call where he was arguing with the umpire, and I mentioned the freebie Chad Green got on the 0-0 slider before the home run. This one was even more egregious. That was a interesting strike zone that, it gave some, took some, bit of a weird one there. But I did want to note, because David Schneider didn't have a hit in a rare start for him, that pretty good process at the plate still.
He did also have two foul balls that were absolutely smoked.
Yes, just missed one.
Two different at-bats that ended in called strike three. There were two moments there where I thought one specifically where I thought that ball was gone. So
yes, I know exactly the one you're talking
improvements,
about.
Improvements, but it's hard not to have the results there. But he is putting together good at bats. That needs to be said.
Yeah, tough business. Okay, let's take a break. Let's talk a little more Eric Lauer. Let's talk some Max Scherzer with Arden Zwelling, who's down in Cleveland. He'll join us on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkin Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Blue Jays win 10-6. Even more exciting than that, perhaps, is that today we'll get to see Max Scherzer. He's back. He pitched three innings back in March. He's made his way back. Let's go down to Cleveland and talk to Arden Zwelling of SportsCenter about it. Arden, good morning, man. How you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Excellent. Excellent. How excited are you to see Max Scherzer back on the mound today?
How am I what to see Max Scherzer? Excited?
Excited, yeah. I know you're a very smart analyst and analyst first, but you're also a baseball fan. I know you've enjoyed getting to talk to Max Scherzer and stuff over the last couple of months.
Yeah, no doubt. It's just you're breaking up on my end. That's why I didn't catch that there. I think everybody's looking forward to watching him pitch. It's Max Scherzer, right? I mean, even just watching back to the last AAA outing, like that's still Max Scherzer. You know, that's still 94 velo. That's still everything in a spot to the edges, in, out, up, down, just toying with hitters. It's a nice blend of both throwing and pitching, if that makes any sense, because he still has the velo and he still has really nasty stuff. But his ability to locate to the edges is essentially second to none over the last 10, 15, 17 years, whatever this has been. So, yeah, who isn't excited to watch him pitch?
Yeah, Arden, we will talk about expectations for tonight and moving forward as well. But as you have had these opportunities to talk to Max Scherzer, to watch him sort of interact with other pitchers on this pitching staff, it seems like it's pretty obvious that the impact goes beyond even what he's doing on the mound, on the field for the Blue Jays. What can a guy like that, you know, add to the pitching staff when he is constantly talking to other guys and breaking things down wherever he is, really?
Yeah, it's like the most expensive pitching coach in the league, I guess, is what he's been to this point. And he didn't pay him all that money just to help, Eric Lauer figure out how to use his cutter more effectively, or, you know, how to help Bowden Francis through what I'm sure were some pretty significant struggles with his confidence earlier this year, more to devise like the, dastardly of sequences with Chris Bassett using five different pitches to tie someone in knots. Like, you pay him that money to pitch and to be Max Scherzer and to stabilize the rotation. So it's time for him to do that. But certainly behind the scenes, yeah, he's talking to everybody. And, you know, you guys, I'm sure, have heard John Schneider say over and over again that, like, every day there's a 30-minute conversation with Max Scherzer where he just goes in the office and says, all right, we got to talk about this and that and this and this thing that we did last night. And here's what we're going to do next time. And, John just kind of kicks back and lets him go. So you guys know the energy and the presence that he's been. It's something else.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So, Arden, when it comes to you're down in Cleveland, so I know you've been in that room yesterday. As far as expectations go, we heard on the weekend that, you know, this is a Wednesday start with a Sunday side session instead of Tuesday and Saturday, maybe because he felt a little bit of extra soreness coming out of that last rehab start. Not entirely surprising given the quick ramp back up here. But what are we expecting from him in terms of a pitch count, in terms of how much they'll monitor just how he feels today and after the start, in terms of, you know, next steps and how where he slots in from here?
You know, if you get 85 pitches, five and dive, like, I think you take that and you run and you just don't look back. Like, I think the Blue Jays would be very happy with that. Certainly the stuff, I mean, there wasn't a ton of degradation in it at AAA from what we've seen prior. And you would expect things to kind of tick up a little bit in a big league environment with the adrenaline going and, being in front of the extra deck in the stadium. So it's going to be very much a monitor it and check in with him between innings and wait and see and anyone who tells you today that they know what to expect from Max Scherzer tonight is lying and full of crap. Max Scherzer doesn't know what to expect, as he perpetually reminds us after each session, each time that he's throwing off a mound. So, yeah, I mean, we're all along for the ride, really. He's just gotten to this point in his rehab, in his season, in his odyssey with this thumb issue where he said it still doesn't feel 100%. He still doesn't know how it's going to feel in the major league environment. He doesn't know how it's going to feel when he pushes past the 75 pitches that he's been to. He's very much just letting Jesus take the wheel and seeing where he ends up.
Yeah, that's a good point. I forget who it was that asked during the homestand, asked John Schneider, how much can you replicate, right, a major league environment through rehab outings and AAA and things of that nature? And John Schneider said, for Max, there's no way. There's absolutely no way to do that. He will be himself once he gets back on the major league mound.
I will say the two plate appearances against Will Urabreu in his AAA start seemed like he kind of stepped up. They had a nice like multi-pitch battle both times, but maybe that's the only instance.
Yeah, and Scherzer also said that he was indeed, you know, looking forward to facing Abreu himself, who's obviously a big league caliber hitter. But keeping sort of in the subject of we don't know what we're going to expect, and there will be a cap on his pitch count. You see Eric Lauer going 5 1/3 yesterday. The Blue Jays used a lot of relievers. What can this back-to-back sort of do for the bullpen, Arden? Do we expect a move for length? How are you looking at this?
Well, you know, no one went particularly long yesterday other than Paxton Schultz. I mean, you know, Braden Fisher threw 7 pitches. You know, Yariel threw 11. So I think you could go back to those two guys. You know, we'll see if they want to go back to Mason Fluardi again, considering the command issues that he had. I mean, Chad Green is not going to be someone who's going to be anywhere near leverage anyway. So I think they're pretty well covered. Brandon Little didn't pitch yesterday. Jeff Hoffman is going to be available. Nick Sandlin will be available. So, you know, if they wanted to, I mean, somebody's going to have to come off the roster for Scherzer. And I would imagine it's Paxton Schultz just because he has those options. And somebody's going to have to come off the 40-man as well with the trade that the Blue Jays made just to get Scherzer back onto the 40. So we'll see who that is. But, yeah, I think that that'll all take care of itself. And I don't expect they're going to call up anybody for the bullpen. I think they should be fine. Now, if they get a really short Scherzer outing and they have to go very deep into their bullpen, then they absolutely, like, early this evening need to be getting on the phone to Casey Kandel and figuring out who they're going to get up for the day game on Thursday, because then they would really be stretched. But, you know, you can leave that disaster planning for when the time comes.
The trade Arden is referring to, by the way, the Jays have acquired Robinson Pena from the Marlins. He was just designated for assignment right after his major league debut. The Jays sending out Colby Martin, a converted Division III infielder who they took in the 16th round last year and has hit 102 on the gun. But Pena, nice splitter slider combination. Maybe someone they think they can work with there more than Miami could. Arden, with respect to Lauer, to go back to yesterday a little bit, you wrote this terrific piece on him coming out of spring training about him going to Korea and making it back and why he, you know, was gambling on himself on a minor league deal with the Blue Jays. What have you seen from him over these first couple starts, and just how impressed are you that that has all been able to not only translate, but translate super effectively?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that he did in Korea was he got healthy and he got to the bottom of some arm issues that he was dealing with over the last couple of years that like just really derailed what was a super consistent, steady, like back rotation, even mid rotation starter when he was in Milwaukee. And what it came down to was that he had these nerve issues, and you know, he got to a point where he had, you know, bursitis in the shoulder and he had elbow inflammation, because it's kind of similar to Scherzer, like because of these nerve issues, like he was compensating with a lot of other musculature in his arm. And he got to a point where, you know, when he was like behind his head, like with his arm in his delivery, he couldn't even feel his arm. Like he didn't know where it was in space. So then all of a sudden, like your mechanics are shot, your velo's shot, your command is shot, your confidence is shot, you end up in Korea. So when he went over there, you know, kind of got a mix, a taste of the Eastern medicine a little bit and some new ideas on what he could do to sort of address the nerve issues, and worked really hard over the off season to do some, pathway grooving with his nerves, which is something he explained to me and something that I don't understand the first thing about, but sounded really meticulous and painful at times. But he's at a point now where he can feel his arm in space. So he's got his delivery back under control. The velo is just now coming back. We saw him up to 94 last night. That's something that he was doing earlier in his career that went away when he had the physical issues. So the delivery mechanics are back, the velo's back, and now he kind of has the benefit of the league not having seen him for a while. So there is a little bit of element of surprise. And he also just has a deep arsenal where he can be a different guy each time out. But the last two times out, we saw that cutter up in the zone was really effective for him. Well, yesterday, all of a sudden, it's like curveballs and sliders and keeping a lineup with eight righties in it off balance and like getting through a third trip and showing them a third look. That's really big for him. So I think it's just been a slow process of really getting himself back to health, back into the physical place he needs to be effective.
Yeah, that's such a good point because, you know, sometimes the body kind of fails you, right? And you do need to, if you're lucky, you figure it out and you're able to come back. But you talk about the deep repertoire. You talk about the fact that, you know, the league hasn't seen him for a little bit, but he's still working to stay one step ahead. And when we speak to Lauer as well, I was just, you know, talking to Blake in the first segment here, it's very clear that he knows what he's trying to do and who he is and how he can maybe stay one step ahead. What does that tell you about a pitcher and just his mental makeup, the baseball IQ, that he is able to use that repertoire as effectively as he is right now to keep hitters guessing?
Well, yeah, this is something that he's done earlier in his career as well. Like when he was in Milwaukee, you know, there were times where, he really upped his cutter usage. You know, he came in as just like a big four-seam guy. And then that started getting hit. So they said, okay, what if you just cut the ball a little bit? And then he got to a point after the pandemic where it was, all right, let's help you develop a changeup because, you know, the two fastballs maybe are starting to get a little bit predictable. So, you know, in like 21, all of a sudden he's throwing a bunch of changeups. And I was talking to him the other day, you know, that's still something that he's working on. He doesn't have a ton of confidence in the pitch right now, so you don't see it a whole lot, but he would very much like that to become a bigger part of his arsenal. I think he's just like a really smart guy when it comes to what he has on a given day and how to maximize what he has. So I think, you know, going into a game, he's got a game plan. He understands how he wants to attack different guys. He's talked to Tyler Heineman or Alejandro Kirk about it. But then I'm sure he goes out to the bullpen and then just gets a feel for like what's working. You know, am I getting that good like induced vertical break on my fastball? Am I getting that ride? Or, you know, is the cutter like actually something I'm locating more consistently? Do I have to lean on that? I mean, yesterday, when you have control and command of two breaking balls, like you could do a lot. You know, when you got a slider and a curveball that you can land for strikes and expand the zone with, that's how you get through a lineup three times, is when you can mix and match those pitches before even getting to the firmer stuff up in the zone. So, I just think that, you know, when you have that deep arsenal, it just gives you more avenues, more routes, and more ways to be effective on a given day when maybe you aren't feeling your best with somebody else.
And when you're getting run support, it really does tie it all together, which is something that the Blue Jays gave him as well. And I know that Bo Bichette didn't have any RBIs yesterday, Arden, but I was fascinated by something that you mentioned, you brought up in the broadcast, which is Bo Bichette may be on pace for a 100-plus RBI season, and that would put him in a pretty select group of guys who have been able to do that from that top spot. Now, you know, obviously this is kind of what he was born to do, it feels like, right? Is just drive in runs. But does that also tell you a bit about the bottom of the Blue Jays lineup and setting up Bo for those moments?
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing a great job all year of getting on base, and we've been talking about it ad nauseum, but you know, it's really impactful for a guy like Bo Bichette at the top of the lineup, who as a leadoff hitter is guaranteed one plate appearance per game where he's got nobody on base. And like here he is leading the Blue Jays in RBIs and, top five in the league and hitting with runners in scoring position. And as you said, on pace for 100 RBIs in the season, which as a leadoff hitter is like actually incredibly rare. Kyle Schwarber's done it, Acuna's done it, Mookie Betts has done it, but there's only like five guys over the last decade who've had 100 RBIs at the leadoff spot. So it's kind of a rare thing. And Bo could do it this year because of, you know, the Ernie Clements at the bottom of the lineup, or the Tyler Heinemanns, or, you know, Andrés Giménez getting on base last night was helpful. And also because Bo has just like come through in those spots when he's had runners on at like one of the best clips in baseball. He's got like 40 RBIs with runners in scoring position this year, which is top 10 in baseball. So yeah, it's a credit to both, obviously the bottom of the lineup getting on, and then Bo rising to the occasion in those moments.
Yeah, it's a fun list of guys. Marcus Semien is on there as well. Charlie Blackman, Ronald Acuna Jr. It's a pretty exclusive club. Arden, you mentioned Andrés Giménez there. What have you seen from him at the plate? Obviously, the glove looked very slick yesterday. He's already, even with the missed time, kind of 95th percentile for defensive value. We know what he does on that side. It's been a bit of a slow go on the offensive side. His primary on-base tool has been getting hit by pitches recently. A nice stretch of games there. Look, when they acquired him, I looked under the hood and I saw a path back to being roughly a league average hitter. Maybe not the 130 WRC plus he had a few years back, but a guy who could be about average at the plate. I'm feeling a little less confident about that today. What are you seeing with Andrés Giménez at the plate?
It's interesting because, you know, the chase isn't much different. The whiff isn't much different. Like the exit velos, the hard hit rate, like it's all kind of lining up with what he's been in recent seasons. And somehow he's actually kind of not the hitter he's been in recent seasons, which is saying something, because in those recent seasons, he was really not the hitter he was in seasons recent to those. So, Leo, we can get into expected stats, and, you know, he's got a pretty big gulf between his expected numbers and his actual numbers, and everybody's mileage is going to vary on that. You know, I think if you're the Blue Jays right now, you trust it, and you know, trust that it'll come through, and maybe there's some little tweaks you can make in terms of just like shape of contact, point of contact at the plate, you know, what he's attacking, what he's not. I think you like that the contact rate is always there and the whiff rate is always low. And he is somebody who is going to put the ball in play and not strike out. So I think if he's like hitting seventh, eighth, ninth and playing the defense that he is, then great, like hunky dory. But, you know, I think the issue is when he's hitting like fifth or sixth or cleanup, when, as he was on opening day, you know, you just need something a bit more potent in those spots. So it really kind of depends on, in a funny way, the order around him. Like if you're relying on him to produce runs and to be an offensive force in your lineup, yeah, that's going to leave something to be desired. But if he's just at the bottom of the lineup, working on, you know, working at bats and fouling pitches off, putting the ball in play, moving runners, some of that little stuff the Blue Jays talk about so often, that's a better fit for him right now with what he's able to provide offensively.
Arden, before we let you go, just because you're there, I know you were getting the injury updates at the start of this series yesterday. It sounded like from your tweets and your reporting, a little bit of a minor setback for Dalton Varsho and not much progress for Anthony Santander. What can you tell us about where those two are in the rehab right now?
Yeah, Varsho had a little bit of tightness crop up in his hamstring while he's running the bases on Monday. So the Blue Jays kind of downplaying it. There's, you know, he's still hitting. He's still taking fly balls. They're going to see how it goes. We're not in Florida, so it's impossible to know exactly how severe that setback is. It really will be dependent on, like, is he running the bases again later this week? If it bleeds into next week, then, you know, it was like a, you know, a serious setback. But if he's able to get out and run later this week, then it's okay. It was just minor, and, you know, he should be on a similar track to where he was coming back. And, yeah, Anthony Santander still isn't swinging the bat. So this is not a guy who's going to be back with the Blue Jays before the All-Star break. I mean, late July is probably like a best case scenario at this point, really. Like the guy hasn't swung a bat in weeks. It's going to take him some time to kind of get back to, not just like game shape and kind of the readiness that he needs to compete at the big league level, but also like think about all the adjustments he was working on and think about all the things that he was trying to figure out with his swing while he was hurt earlier this year. Like that process was interrupted as well, and that process has to continue. So, I'm not expecting to see Anthony Santander at the Blue Jays anytime soon.
Yeah, that's get ready for your, it's like a trade deadline acquisition talking points. It's not like that, but it'd be nice to see him back. That's good information there, Arden. Thank you for that. Thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. Enjoy Mad Max tonight.
All right. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Arden Zoelling of Sportsnet on the sideline beat for this series on Sportsnet Television. Of course, indispensable on social media as well. I mentioned briefly there I didn't know if Arden had seen the news yet before he came on, so I didn't want to put him on the spot. But yes, the Jays traded for Robinson Pena from the Marlins. They sent out Colby Martin, who's that interesting 16th rounder that I mentioned, who hit 102, had a 154 ERA at A-ball and had just gotten promoted to Vancouver, actually. So they obviously see something in Robinson Pena if they're going to give up even though a high A relief prospect is, you know, the attrition rate on those guys is so high, you're still giving up something of note there. Pena is 26. He's also a converted infielder, has options. So, you know, not necessarily someone who's going to factor into the major league mix, but will need a 40-man spot eventually. 347 ERA at AAA this year as a starter. He only got that one inning with Miami before they DFA'd him. But you can squint and see what they're looking at here. Strikeout rate isn't crazy, but good ground ball rate. Doesn't walk a lot of guys. Some solid chase and swing and miss numbers. But most notably, he has a very, very good splitter. And you look at his pitch mix, especially if they're going to potentially convert him to a reliever instead of a starter, ditch some of those sinkers, hammer the splitter a little bit more. The slider's pretty good as well. You could pretty easily see that. Who knows? Maybe they want him for AAA starting depth, and there's not enough of that in the org, so you just leave him there for now. But longer term, I could certainly see them looking at that profile and being like, yeah, we can work with the splitter-slider combination. They have worked with a lot of splitter guys out of the bullpen and as starters in recent years. So a little bit of interest there. We'll see what the plan is for him. Yeah. I have one other minor league update for you.
Tell me.
San Omosako.
Yes.
The Brazilian prospect.
Yes.
He got five shutout innings as a bulk follower.
Wow.
Yesterday.
Yeah, we're proud of him.
Yes.
As just collectively, as a country,
yes,
we're very proud of him.
In that game, Amir Garrett started. If you remember Amir Garrett from the Cincinnati Reds, one of my favorite guys because he's the best hooper among any player in baseball. He played college basketball.
Yeah.
And him and Joey Votto were always tripping at each other about who is better at basketball. The Jays signed him to a minor league deal in the offseason. This was his first appearance working his way back from injury. It did not go well, but the important thing is get on the mound there. I mentioned Ryan Burr got an inning yesterday.
You did indeed.
Okay.
Yes.
Then we're good on updates.
That's awesome.
Let's take
you
a break
it.
Then. Yeah, let's take a break then. On the other side, we're going to talk to Paul Spohr of Fangraphs. It is a crazy slate of fun pitching around Major League Baseball today. Chase Burns also had a hell of a debut against the Yankees yesterday.
Yep.
We'll talk that. We'll talk Max Scherzer and Eric Lauer with Paul Spohr as well. And then at 11:30, Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter will join us as well. We'll also get you set up for Gavin Williams against Max Scherzer. Although my notes on Max Scherzer are, is Max Scherzer? That's about it. That's about all you need to know. Paul Spohr, Doug Fox, join us in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Fun pitching matchup today with Max Scherzer going against Gavin Williams. Fun pitching matchup last night with Chase Burns making his Major League debut against the Yankees. Fun one this afternoon, 2 o'clock, Paul Skeens against Jacob Mizorowski. A lot of pitching stuff to talk about. Frankie Montas came back after the world's worst rehab assignment and completely baffled the Braves, and then the Mets blew it anyway. Typical stuff over in Mets land. Let's talk some pitching with one of my favorite guys to talk pitching with, Paul Spohr of Fangraphs, of Twitch, Out of the Park Baseball, Sleeper in the Bust, the best mustache in the business. Paul, what's going on, man? How are you?
Not too much. Thanks so much for having me on, y'all.
Appreciate it. I got to say, every time you're on, my mom sends a screenshot of like, this guy's mustache is so great. You're very, I'm sure you're popular with everyone, but you got the mom's market covered. Don't know what that means to you.
That's my target demo. That's fine.
There you go. Moms who play a ton of fantasy baseball. That's Paul Spohr's demo. Man, we're going to talk some fantasy baseball, but before we get into the fantasy specifics, you're a great pitching analyst outside of fantasy as well. Chase Burns debuts for Cincinnati last night, 5 innings against the Yankees, 8 strikeouts, strikes out for 6 of the first 7 batters he faced. Man, what did you see from that? How impressed were you with Burns not only making that start, but doing it against the Yankees and doing it like a year after getting drafted?
Yeah, I mean, there was just so much greatness there with the Chase Burns debut. You talk about how quickly he's up. The number 2 pick last year, debuting against the Yankees. Yeah, it was at home, but that's almost worse because that park is crazy to pitch in. Not that it would have been better in Yankee Stadium, but he was unfazed completely. Like you said, 6 strikeouts in the first 7 batters that he faced. Totally unfazed by a, you know, strong Yankees lineup with the best player in the universe in it, in Aaron Judge. You know, stuff started to degrade a little bit as the start went on, as you would expect from anybody as the adrenaline comes down. What I was really impressed with, and to compare him to somebody who we just saw debut recently that you mentioned earlier, Jacob Mizorowski, who's going to face Paul Skenes today, was Burns's control was a lot more put together, especially in a debut. You know, when the adrenaline's pumping, guys can be throwing the ball all over the place. He had the overpowering stuff, did Burns, like Mizorowski, but he knew where it was going a lot more. And if that is not just kind of, you know, dialing in for your first start and who he is, boy, Chase Burns can be really special right away. I anticipate more command issues as he kind of gets going, just because that's who he is as a flamethrower. But I was so impressed last night by Burns.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with that, because yes, it is impressive, but there is, I guess, another layer to it that is, can you maintain that level of command?
Right.
And is there any way that you could sort of predict where this is going based on, okay, this was the debut. What can we actually expect in terms of that?
It is so hard to take anything from debuts, positive or negative. In the fantasy world, I generally say to fade them. You know, if you, you know, go out and get Chase Burns before the start, I was telling people, but you don't have to start him here. We don't know how this is going to go. Like you said, you never know how the adrenaline's going to be channeled. Some guys, it's overwhelming. They throw the ball all over the place. They're out after 3 innings. Paul Skenes' debut was not that great. So Burns did something special here. But as far as how it predicts what he's going to do, I don't think it really does. I think he's going to have standard up and down struggles of a prospect. But again, the one thing I'm going to be keyed in on is where that command and control sits at, because he did take a step forward with his walk rate this year, dropping it from, 9% in high, excuse me, as he moved up the ladder from high A to double A to triple A, the walk rate continued to get better there. And I really liked what we saw yesterday. If he's not walking guys at, let's say 9%, that's still a little bit worse than average. But if Burns is walking at a 9% or better clip, the Reds got something here, and they're going to need it because Hunter Green is out and this is a contending team. So thinking about the broader baseball picture, it's huge for the Reds if Burns is giving them legit innings every fifth day.
From a fantasy perspective, you mentioned there, you absolutely add Chase Burns, but you don't necessarily have to start him out of the gate. So we went through this with Jacob Mizorowski the other week. Mick Abel was an interesting one when he first came back up. How do you balance the excitement of this guy's awesome and I got him to coming off a debut like that, coming off the debut Mizorowski had, Mick Abel's debut against the Pirates, especially in a redraft league, like the value has probably never been higher to shop one of these guys because people are excited. How do you balance that with these young stud pitchers?
The value probably peaked in like the third inning yesterday when Burns was just fully dialed in. As you start getting on the phone at that point, does anybody want to trade, you know, Francisco Lindor for him or something? It's tough. It's really, really tough. You talk about Mick Abel, that's another great name to invoke. Remember, he faced Skenes in his debut, and I know it was the Pirates offense, so it wasn't that difficult, but he looked amazing. And then he's kind of come back to earth because he's a rookie. I do think that there's a chance to overrate Burns here and put crazy expectations on him. The funny thing is, as good as the start was, and I'm not here to like poo-poo it, still had a 5.40 ERA because he gave up a few runs, 3 runs in 5 innings. I don't put stock into that. I don't think it diminishes the start, but like, this isn't a ready-made ace right away. Very few are. Skenes spoils us right now. So we want Mizorowski to be that. We want Abel to be that. We want Burns to be that. None of them are. And that's nothing against them. Skenes is a generational talent, you know, number one overall pick. He is that guy. I don't think these three are, but I think they're all really good to different levels. I think Burns could be the best. Again, I'm going to keep harping on that command and control because I was so impressed. I expected to kind of see a Mizorowski clone. And the fact that I didn't really blew me away with Burns.
Yeah, there's also the interesting value thing to keep an eye on with these young starters is that there could be pitch limits, innings limits. They're on bad teams, so they might not be getting you wins down the stretch. But the strikeout upside is nice, and they're a lot of fun to tune into. Before we talk about today's big game with Skenes and Mizorowski, to stay with that Red series, Nick Lodolo was short against the Yankees, but he was still pretty solid. I know you guys had kicked around on the sleeper in the bus. Like, is he into kind of auto start territory? Where are you on Nick Lodolo's season at this point?
Yeah, I feel like he has kind of come into a point right now where it's like, I think we got to just kind of have him in there on a set it and forget it type of style right now. You know, he had a two-step this week with the Yankees starting off, and then I don't know who they have this weekend, but I don't see myself taking Lodolo out. I came into the season pretty tepid on Lodolo and Hunter Green. Primarily it was the park, but also with Green last year, he had a great year, no denying it, but I didn't see a big skills jump. And with Lodolo, we've seen the health concerns year in and year out, and with Green, to be honest. So both of them gave me some nerves, but they both looked amazing when they pitched. I know Green is back on the shelf right now, but Lodolo's been really, really good. I think he's in every rotation right now without incident, regardless of league format. I don't think you take Nick Lodolo out of your lineup right now.
Yeah, that's definitely a good development for the Reds. As you said, they needed some positives out of that rotation. And then just, you know, switching gears to the big matchup that is just in a few hours, actually, at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. Eastern between Paul Skeens and Jacob Mizrowski. First and foremost, for you as a baseball fan, as a fantasy guy, how much do you look forward to matchups like these, especially when you don't have to wait all day for them?
They're amazing. First off, I'm a huge day baseball fan. As somebody blessed enough to do baseball for my work and get to be home and never miss things like that and actually get to narrowly focus on things like that as part of my job, it's amazing. So I'm very excited. And with the lessened importance on starters these days, we don't get these big matchups a lot. So I really hope this lives up to the hype. And I know they're not both going to go, you know, a complete game or anything close to that. But I hope we at least get the 5+ out of both of them, because they're both so awesome, Skeens and Mizrowski, that I just want to see them go back and forth and put up like 22 total strikeouts.
Yeah, that 22 would be a little ridiculous,
crazy.
But yeah. So you mentioned the difference between Burns and Mizrowski. Obviously, Burns with a little bit more command. Mizrowski, just I feel like we've been waiting for him to come up since like this time last year when the numbers in the minors were so big. When you look at big picture and that command issues there, obviously the Brewers do not need to decide this anytime soon. But when you're thinking about him for, say, a dynasty league or something like that, how much are you weighing the risk that because of the command profile, he eventually ends up a high-end reliever versus a starter, even though that's probably not on the near-term horizon?
Sure, it's on the table. And you know, if he was somebody, Mizrowski, that was walking like 12%+ all the time, they probably would transition him to the bullpen. But I like that they started him in the rotation. My good friend and former podcast co-host, Eno Saris, always says that the bullpen is sticky. And once you get in there, it can be tough to get out. Now, one of the trends that we've been seeing recently is guys coming out of there, after several years as a reliever or full careers as a reliever. Clay Holmes was a big one this year for the Mets, and he's been great. So it doesn't mean you're destined to be there forever, but with Mizrowski, I like that he didn't come up, even though it's not a bad method to break a pitcher in. I like that he didn't come up in the bullpen, because I do think with somebody who throws 100 like him and does have some control issues, I think it could have gone the way of Josh Hader, which, hey, Josh Hader's on, you know, quite a track for his career as a closer, but we want the big fun starter. And I want to see if this can work as a starter for Mizrowski. Here's the unfun part to talk about. He throws 100. It's kind of an if or a when, not if, with injury. I just hope that it's not terrible, right? Like, I don't want to be so negative about it, but like when somebody averages 100 on their fastball, the track record says that injury will strike at some point. Will they go to the bullpen after that? I hope not. Because here's the thing too, Blake, putting guys in the bullpen has not shown any capacity to keep them healthier.
No, I mean,
nothing has.
Because he's just going to take his 100 and ramp it up to like 102. And then,
right.
Yeah.
How much
Go ahead, Julia.
I am wondering how much that factors into your evaluation for guys. And obviously different leagues have different formats and all of that. But when you kind of have that in the back of your head, how does that sort of factor into your evaluation of a pitcher that, you know, there may be a pretty high risk of injury there?
With every pitcher these days, Julia, I think they all start at a level up here with their injury risk. And then certain guys maybe jump a bit higher. Your guys with career-long history issues, like a Jacob deGrom or whomever. But everyone's starting at the highest. There's no such thing as a safe pitcher. I've been beating that drum now for a couple of years. So I play to the talent. And then with somebody like Mizrowski, where that bullpen path might kind of be there if things really went south, at least it would be a fantasy-relevant bullpen path, right? Because there's likely that he wouldn't be a middle reliever. He would be a closer. So between the potential injury and even the potential closing, it doesn't really take me off Mizrowski. Just give me the best talent. Regardless, you can't plan around injury. The safest guy coming into this year. No one's safer than George Kirby. Spent the first 2 months on the IL, right? Like, there's no such thing as a safe guy. So just give me the most talent. Don't take lesser talent to get perceived safety because it's a mirage. It's a trite little phrase, but every guy is one pitch away. You never know what that next pitch is going to do. So just give me the best talent always.
So with respect to that, and this is more of a draft time question, but maybe some people are looking at trades and things like that. Because of the injury profile and the injury risk, generally with keepers, with dynasty formats, you know, you lean maybe the top hitters over the top pitchers because that risk is there. How much does, like, when it's a guy as good as Paul Skenes, even though he's not going to win 20 games for his career, maybe, let alone in a season. How much has he shifted your willingness to be like, you know what, in a dynasty, in a keeper format, Paul Skenes is just, like you said, give me the talent. What level do you have to be as a pitcher to start to change that hitter versus pitcher accounting at the top of a dynasty ranking?
You got to be up there. You got to be one of those bona fide aces, like a Skenes and Skubal, who were first round guys in a lot of leagues this year. You're talking dynasty, so long term. I know somebody like Zach Wheeler's a bit older now, but cycle back a few years ago when he really emerged into an ace. He's been that guy now for a few years. We just lost a guy who I think was somebody that you could have chased in dynasty, Corbin Burnes. You know, he kept putting up great season after great season. But you got to be that bona fide ace for me to really chase, because otherwise I'm with you, Blake. When two talents are equal in a trade situation like that, I'm always going to choose the hitter in a keeper or dynasty situation. But I say always with that little star next to it, because it's not actually always. It's a little bit of BS there, because if you start talking Skenes, Skubal, Wheeler, handful of other guys, then it starts to come into the picture where I'll take the pitcher there. But generally, I want to have my hitting foundation, and I'll find pitching, you know, developed as mid to late round guys off the waiver wire or just at the draft table in general. I really want to keep hitting. It's just more bankable over the years.
Okay, so someone I'm absolutely not keeping in a dynasty or keeper format, but I am curious to hear your take. I mean, he spent some years with the Tigers, so you're very familiar. Max Scherzer's back tonight. Fantasy stuff aside, how excited are you to see him back on a hill?
Barry, anytime Max Scherzer's pitching, I'm there. You mentioned that he was a Tiger, that my favorite team kind of developed him, really. After Arizona, he kind of had the most of his growth with the Tigers, so I've always had a soft spot for Maxi. I'm very excited. Thing is, though, with that thumb, are we really past it? He said earlier this year when it first got hurt and everything was going kind of crazy, like, it's going to be hard to deal with this. So I'm tempering my expectations, but anytime Scherzer's back on the bump, I'm getting excited, because he's a Hall of Famer, and anytime you get a chance to watch a Hall of Famer, even toward the end of his career, you should take that opportunity.
Yeah, we knew, and the Blue Jays knew when they signed him, that it was a risk, and I can only imagine that it is an equally big and significant risk to have Max Scherzer in a fantasy league right now.
Right.
How do you even begin to assess a guy like that who has missed so much time? We really don't know what to expect. Is the sort of the directive just stay away for now?
No, honestly, I'll go for Scherzer. You know, in certain leagues, shallower formats, he was probably popping up on waiver wires as people's ILs were starting to fill up. You got a 40-year-old who hasn't been a god over the last few years. He's still a big name, but I'm sure he was popping up on some waiver wires. I would have been holding in medium and deeper leagues to see what can happen with Scherzer, because here's the thing. When healthy, and that has been rare in these last couple of years, but when healthy, he's still a very competent pitcher. He puts up quality whips, decent ERAs. Jays have been playing well lately, so he's got solid win opportunity with the way that offense has been playing. So Scherzer's still somebody that I want in every format, and we'll see where it goes. I hope it's not just a couple starts and then back on the aisle or anything like that, but the upside is still real for any fantasy format to want Max Scherzer.
Paul, we mentioned Max's time with the Tigers. That included four playoff runs and a Cy Young, a trip to the World Series, leading the league in wins a couple of times. Do you have any favorite Max Scherzer memories from your time kind of watching him as a fan, not an analyst?
It was a playoff situation. I think it was one of the times he came in as a reliever. Because the Tigers, you know, the reason they never won a series during that run there is pretty much the bullpens were always kind of rotten. So they started to use some of the starters there. Verlander had a relief stint. Scherzer had one. But then he comes off after a big performance and gives the hardest high five I've ever seen. Like, we all know Max is a freak, right? And I swear he tried to break somebody's arm. I forget who it was. It might have been like Delmon Young or something. He's giving him a high five, and I think he was trying to rip his arm out of the socket. And it was the most quintessential Max moment I've never forgotten. It's burned in my brain forever.
Well, let me sneak in one more Blue Jays pitcher question here then. We saw Eric Lauer pitch very, very well again yesterday, sort of mix his pitches in a different way than we had seen earlier this season. What is the level of trust with a guy who hasn't been around or hasn't been back for a long time? The sample is kind of small still, but where do you stand with Eric Lauer?
I'm a Lauer stan. This is somebody I've always liked over the years. I love what Milwaukee was able to get out of him. He's one of those guys who went over to the KBO, kind of remade himself, comes back this year, and looks pretty sharp. Now, look, 2.21 ERA, 1.01 WHIP, that ain't happening. I'm not putting that on really hardly any guys. The guys we were talking about earlier, the Skeens and Scooble types, those are the guys you expect that from. But we have ERA indicators like FIP and Sierra, and those are putting him at like the mid to upper threes. 3.69 on his Sierra, that's skill interactive ERA, and 384 on the FIP, fielding independent pitching. And again, those are both on the ERA scale. That's what you should think of with Eric Lauer, a competent number four who can kind of pitch like a number three when he's really at his best, but somebody that they can rely on, I think. And they've stretched him out now to where he can get true starts. I like when they give him an opener too. That's just good from a fantasy angle to get a win more easily. But I like Lauer. I think as long as he stays healthy, they've got someone that they can rely on for legitimate starts right now.
All right, final question before we let you go here, Paul. I know you got to take in a Savannah Bananas game a couple weeks back for the first time. How was that experience?
It was amazing. It lived up completely to the hype. Went to Charlotte to visit a couple college buddies, and we had an absolutely amazing time. We've been trying for 3 years. We got a friend who came in from Oregon. I'm here in Texas, and our buddy lives in Charlotte, and we kind of covered each of the three regions the last 3 years. Anything that was relatively close, we tried to get in the lottery. He just couldn't get it. Wow. He gets in for Charlotte. We go visit him. Again, totally lived up to the hype. They brought out a bunch of Carolina Panthers for the special players. There was a walk-off homer to win it. There's just so much going on all the time. I think it's a wonderful event. I love how popular it is. I'm a huge baseball nerd, right? But I understand that like core baseball, especially today's three true outcome game, is kind of boring. Even as somebody who loves it, it can be boring. Savannah Banana Baseball is made to not be boring, and it wasn't at all. I recommend it for anybody, whether you're a baseball diehard or a baseball hater even. I think it can even bring on baseball haters. My favorite thing is, if there's a foul ball hit in the stands and a fan catches it, it's an out. That's amazing. And we had two of them. It was awesome.
It would change how I view the games at Rogers Center, because often I'll do my pregame stuff and then I'll go sit in seats to just like be a fan, have a beer, meet some friends or whatever. And the catch rate for Toronto Blue Jays fans on even ones you can like park right under, pretty low. Would be costing the team here. Yeah. Paul, thanks so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, y'all. Take care.
Paul Spohr of FanGraphs, also streams on Twitch. Also a part of the staff at Out of the Park Baseball, which is the only video game I've played for the last like 15 years because I'm not a video game guy. Sleeper in the Bust is the fantasy podcast over at FanGraphs as well. Some fun stuff there.
Very much so.
Yeah, a little more optimistic on Max Scherzer from a fantasy perspective than I expected as well. Because he's kind of right around the ownership threshold in a lot of leagues. Yeah. I know you don't play, but...
I don't. I mean, not for any specific reason, just because I don't think...
You get it. You hate nerds and hate data and hate baseball.
Well, yes, all of that. But also, it's just, I don't have that much free time in my hands anymore.
Yeah. Here's an interesting one for you, since you're trading me out for show tomorrow. Show and I are against each other in the Fan 590 league this week. It's the regular season. Like, Show and I are both probably... I think we met in the fantasy football finals as well. For the league, I think we're both like confident enough that like you're not really that worried about like making the playoffs. We'll probably both be in there.
Okay.
So this one doesn't have that much.
This is just for fun, then.
I mean, yeah. I would rather win the matchup than lose it. But I don't think either of us are like, oh no, season's on the line. Right. Got to beat the other one.
When does that matchup end?
Sunday. So it's a week long matchup.
All right. I'll ask you how it goes then, or how it went on Monday.
Yeah, it's fine.
You'll be here on Monday, right?
I'll be here on Friday as well.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's the NBA draft's only 2 days. We're good. Although Monday is the start of free agency, so it's possible that I'm on the show quite distracted on Monday. We'll see how that goes. Maybe I'll have to bring Sho Ali back again. Let's take a break right now. Let's bring Doug Fox back on the other side. Let's talk some Blue Jays prospects and hear about what Doug was not at Buffalo, but Doug talks to a lot of people in the Blue Jays organization, and they have been raving about, it's cool that Max Scherzer is back at the major league level, but boy, did he make an impression while he was in the minor leagues rehabbing as well. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Doug on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Jays and Guardians continue their series down in Cleveland at 6:40 tonight. Max Scherzer will take on Gavin Williams. We will talk about that one a little bit more because it's Max Scherzer and it's fun, and we always preview the game anyway. Mm-hmm. Gavin Williams, you throw a lot of 97-mile-an-hour fastballs, and it's your worst pitch. I don't really quite understand. We'll see how that goes tonight. Jays have done pretty well against velocity up this year. But we're going to take a look down on the farm before we set up tonight's game. We're talking to Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter, an indispensable part of being a Blue Jays fan at this point. Doug, good morning, and what a terrific Zoom background you've got there. That's a great look.
It's not Bailey Stadium, where I'm currently thousands of kilometers away from, but my heart is definitely there. And the Seas are home for, I think, 8 more games as part of a 9-game homestand. So I know they're going to have great crowds, great support coming up this next week and a half.
Well, always a good time at the Nat. They've also won 22 of their last 26. So good time to be a Vancouver Canadiens baseball fan. I believe Hazel May is there right now, actually. Yes. doing some stuff.
I believe I see her in the background.
Doug, we will talk some Vancouver Canadians. We'll talk some prospects, but Max Scherzer is also coming up from the minors today. Technically, I'm not going to ask you for the Max Scherzer scouting report. He's been around for like 20 years. We get the idea at this point. But I know that in your chats with people around the Blue Jays organization, he also got rave reviews for just his presence while he was down in the minor leagues rehabbing. What can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. I think these guys know what kind of influence that they have by their presence. And I mean, not that I would excuse him for it, but I would almost understand if Max Scherzer, who is, I mean, going to the Hall of Fame, multiple Cy Young Awards, if there was a sense of entitlement with him. But that was not the case while he was in Buffalo. For certain, pitching coach Drew Hayes of the Bison said he could not believe how much respect that Scherzer treated himself and everybody else with. And rehabbing MLB players coming through or young players invited to major league spring training, that's such an influence, such a positive influence on them. And you go back as far as the Jose Bautista, Josh Donaldson days, and Anthony Alford told me what an influence they were on him just by their work ethic and just by the positivity. And so that was a real plus. I think it gave everybody in Buffalo, because the Bisons had a bit of a long first half, but I think it gave everybody on the team a lift.
Yeah, that's a great point. We've been talking about that over here in the majors as well, right? Just the influence of having a Max Scherzer to talk to people and to be around and all of that. And I can only imagine really what that does for minor leaguers in that Bison's clubhouse to have that presence there, be able to pick his brain, see how he goes about his business. That's huge. And Doug, listen, this farm system has had more things to be proud of and to be happy about, you know, beyond rehabbing Hall of Famers and things of the sort. We know you spoke to Joe Sclafani recently, the Blue Jays player development director. Is that his title there? Yeah. First of all, how weird was it getting that call a day early? Mm-hmm. And how did that conversation go with him?
Yeah, my wife and I were on a sweat-filled and bug-infested hike on the Bruce Trail and heard the phone ringing, and there was just no way that I could answer it. And then a text arrived shortly afterwards, and it was Joe basically saying, sorry, I had my days wrong, but I was so excited to talk about the farm system that I just lost track of the days. Just great conversation with Joe. He's always really, really good with his time. And he has reason to be a little bit upbeat. I know, Blake, you were talking maybe a week or two ago. I heard you talk about it seems like it's a baseball universal where fans think their bullpen sucks, their hitters don't drive in runs with runners in scoring position. And let me add to that, for fans maybe outside of the Dodgers and Red Sox, our farm system sucks. The Blue Jays, maybe not so much anymore. Is it an upper level system brimming with elite talent? No, but they have two guys in the top 100, according to most rankings, and Treya Savage and Arjun Nimbala. Johnny King sounds very much to be on the cusp of that. And then you're going to get a decent player with your first round pick. So things certainly look a lot different from where they were a year ago. And that's part of that goes, I think the credit goes to player development. Where guys like Pinyongo and Shrek and Paulino came to the organization, struggled a little bit because that's quite an adjustment to make. But they've taken off this season. And so kudos to the minor league scouts. Kudos to the player development people as well.
When it comes to the player development side, how much are you able, when you have chats with people like Joe Sclafani, I know you talk to other people in the organization as well, how much are you able to glean what the org's philosophy is generally, and when it comes to player development? I ask this in particular because, look, some of the buzziest names early this year were hitters, but we look at where the weaknesses have been in the system and where they're having success this year. It seems like they've taken a step forward on the pitching side as well. Now, whether that's Justin Lehrer coming into the organization or that's a change in philosophy, are you able to kind of glean where those philosophical or developmental changes in perspective come?
I think the impact of Justin Lehrer can't be overstated. He's brought in a different mindset. He's brought in a different way of analyzing how pitchers ramp up in the spring. And touch wood, we have healthy players right now. And pitching is the strength of this organization, despite 7 or 8 of their top pitching prospects recovering from Tommy John. So, yes, I definitely get a sense from Joe. He was very excited, talked with great excitement about Justin. And at the same time, you can also kind of glean there's a little bit of impatience. I mean, they try to keep things positive, but certainly when our conversation turned to Aurelvis Martinez, for example, like the Blue Jays are going to give him every chance to play his way into a big league role. But he has really fallen off lately, and they're trying to get things on track. But you can sense that little bit of impatience. Sometimes it's kind of a reading between the lines sort of thing, but it's definitely there.
You mentioned the pitchers rehabbing, you know, elbow procedures, whatever those may be, whether it's Tommy John, internal brace, the hybrids or whatever. There is a lot of that going on in the Blue Jays system,
including
right
media
now.
At this point. Yeah.
Come on. Yeah. Talk about impatience.
Who's on the IL?
Me. It's been a running joke that my elbow has been wonky this baseball season.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
too,
you know,
curveballs.
And listen, it happens, right? And obviously there's reason to be frustrated with that. But something that stood out to me in your newsletter and your talk with Sclafani was that it seems like these guys are finding a bit of camaraderie in that moment of rehabbing all together. Different levels, different ages for sure. But there's something there, right? In just being able to have a community, really, as you're going through this tough time.
Absolutely. Tommy John, I think a lot of fans don't realize, recovering from Tommy John surgery, whether it's the brace or the full Tommy John, it tends to be not only is a long process, we're talking almost a year and a half before players on average get back to their former level, but it can be a very lonely one. And if there is a benefit, a silver lining from this cloud, it's that group has really bonded. That's rehabbing in Florida. And as Ricky Meinhold, one of the Blue Jays' new pitching development coordinators, told me in the spring, is that they're all looking forward to winning together at whatever level they wind up at as their rehab's complete. So it's something that definitely every organization is going through. I know people on Twitter are saying, well, it's an organizational failure on the part of the Blue Jays. Everybody is going through it. The Yankees, the Red Sox, the Orioles have gone through it. It was addressed in length, as I wrote in the newsletter, Joe said, at the farm directors meeting back at the winter meetings. And it's something that Major League Baseball continues to study. And I'm no orthopedic surgeon, as I wrote, but we know a lot of that damage is cumulative. And so baseball in general, not just specific organizations, but baseball as a sport, whether it be the collegiate level, the amateur level, independent ball, kids baseball, that's something that needs a coordinated effort, I think, to try to overcome.
Yeah, if you want the context of how much this affects every organization, not just the Blue Jays, John Morielli at MLB Player Analysts on Baseball keeps this giant Tommy John surgery database, and you can open it up. It's free to look at it. The link is in his Twitter bio, and you can see everyone who's had the Tommy John, the internal brace, et cetera, over the years, and he tries to keep data on this stuff. So it's pretty overwhelming just how big that spreadsheet is at this point. And then, yeah, you mentioned it's a long time for guys to get back to the same level. The average is about 614 days from surgery to getting back to the same level, about 508 days to get back to that first game. And maybe most at home for the Toronto Blue Jays, 155 days to start throwing again. Ricky Tiedemann started throwing last week. Brandon Barriera has gotten back into games with a small pitch count at the FCL level here. Doug, what can you tell us about where those two guys are in particular in the rehab based on your conversations with Joe?
I haven't had any feedback on exactly when Tiedemann's first bullpen was. And things are day by day, certainly in this kind of situation. So I don't know when he threw it. Don't know what the recovery is like, and we're probably not going to know for some time. Or it seems like the conduit for a lot of that information is John Schneider. So that's next time you're talking to Schneider, or maybe our good friend Keegan Matheson can do a little bit of prodding in that direction. But I think that's where we are. We're at with Tiedemann. There can be bumps in the road. There can be setbacks. It's certainly not a linear progress. Barriera, because he had the surgery earlier, is a little bit further ahead. He's struggled in a couple of rehabs in the Florida Complex League. Nothing to be terribly concerned about. It's more the Blue Jays are erring on the side of caution. And when he gets to a certain number of pitches in an inning, when he's been struggling with his command, well, we know mechanics tend to get sloppy, and that's when injuries occur. So that's why his last, I think, two starts have been under 20 pitches. It's just because he hasn't been able to land enough pitches for strikes to be able to get out of the first inning. But certainly baby steps. And we certainly, you know, going back to that timeline that we've talked about, like, there's still quite a lengthy period before Barriera is even going to be playing full season ball again.
I'll tell you who hasn't been implementing baby steps so far this season. That is Trey Savage, who has absolutely just torn through the levels that he has been in so far, arrives at Double A now. And listen, I think we kind of all expected this to happen, right? This promotion this year. It was very quick with the way that it happened. And not just him. We look at Cal Steven, Gage Stanifer, who started in Florida and then made their way to Vancouver. It was really interesting to me to read just Sclafani's comments about whether this is now a model, something that the Blue Jays are going to try to follow moving forward, or if this is on a case-by-case basis. What was the impression that you got from the organization in that talk?
I think the organization poured a lot of resources and time and research into this very topic, Julia. They looked at the average number of rain dates in the Northwest League, because certainly Trey is Savage, everybody knows, he was far above single A ball or low A ball, which more and more people seem to still be referring to it as. But they wanted consistency of routines, consistency of making his starts. So that's why they decided to start Savage along with the other two in Dunedin. And wouldn't this be one of the drier springs we've had in the Northwest? But they also did some research, interestingly enough, and I would love to know more about this, just on the effect of that cooler, damp Pacific Northwest spring air on certain pitches, with the implication being what is the impact on arms as well, and then in pitching development. So I think it definitely, they've got them close to home to start their pro careers. They've got all the advantages of the minor league complex and state of the art facilities, and then they want to slowly move them up. Some people, of course, a little over a year ago, after Savage was drafted, were speculating that maybe he started at Double A. Good thing he didn't, because the northeastern weather was about as bad as it could be at both Triple A and Double A International League and Eastern League this year. So I think the Blue Jays made a wise move. And yes, I do think that that's probably going to be their template moving forward. And let's not forget about Yu Savage, is that, you know, Chase Burns had a sizzling Major League debut. Yu Savage outpitched him in a regional game last year. So maybe that's not a direct comp, but that speaks to what kind of competitor Trey Yu Savage is. And I certainly would expect he's going to be in the rotation a year from now.
Well, it's not the only Yu Savage Burns comp either. Fangraphs recently released their updated midseason pitching prospect projection. So they have a team of scouts that includes scouting and stats and things like that. And then there is a stats-only model. And in that stats-only model, Trey Yu Savage is second only to Chase Burns among pitching prospects, ahead of Jacob Mizorowski, ahead of Jonah Tong, who is a hot pitching prospect for the Mets. Now, Trey Yu Savage has, like, the lowest reliability score of those top names because it's still so early and the sample so small. But interesting to see there. It is also Trey Yu Savage Day today, by the way. He'll pitch for New Hampshire. Gage Stanifer will pitch for the Vancouver Canadiens. Doug, in your sense, I know we don't get to watch these ones as much, but just to round out the pitching, the top pitching prospect discussion, when are we going to see Johnny King in Dunedin?
My people say soon. He's currently ensconced in several protective layers of bubble wrap. And with each start, a layer comes off. His fastball is electric. He pounds the strike zone. Great athlete, huge guy. All of those things. He has the intangibles. The thing that he needs, which is why he's in the complex league, is that third pitch. And just speaking with somebody in the organization about it yesterday, he's showing tremendous feel for a changeup. So if you can, I'm sure it's still a work in progress because it's such a feel pitch, but you pair that with a 97 mile per hour fastball and a plus curveball, then you're looking at a guy with a starter's arsenal who can add another pitch as he goes. But I would say we're going to see him sooner rather than later at some point in July. Might get shut down in August when he reaches his innings limit, but really hopeful that that we're going to get a chance to see him.
Do you get a feeling that Sclafani is maybe getting tired of being asked of Johnny King and when he's going to move up?
I said, Joe, please text me. I don't do this because people in the Jays organization get inundated. I don't ask other people about injuries, but I said, Joe, not that I'm trying to win a Pulitzer here, but I would love to break the news of King being promoted. And he said, join the line.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good laugh. Okay, Doug, Sclafani aside, I want to throw a couple prospects at you before we let you go here. One that you and I have DM'd about a little bit is Tucker Tolman, who was a top pick a couple years back. Really didn't get off to a great start in his first couple years in the minors. Starting to show signs of life now. What have you seen or heard about Tucker Tolman and where he's at in year three?
Well, I know last year when they sent him back to the complex, they had him working on many of the same things Arjun Namala was working on, and having to do with posture at the plate, which hopefully would get the barrel through the zone quicker. Tucker's always had a great approach. He's always been among, here in his third year at low A, been among the league leaders in pitches seen and pitches per at bat. But sometimes that's translated into a bit of passivity, and he just has not barreled up a lot of balls. But he has been, in all of low A, one of the hottest hitters over the past month. And I think things are finally clicking for him. Apparently he's another one of those slow starters as well. And he certainly was true to form in that case. But I think the people in Vancouver are going to be excited to have him in the second half, because I expect he's going to be joining, I guess, the departed Colby Martin now. But he's going to be in Vancouver, and probably he won't be the only one on that that flight, which is apparently quite a flight to get from,
I bet,
from Vancouver to, like, they usually fly kids to Seattle, have somebody come and pick them up. But apparently it's even more complicated, as I guess you might expect when thinking about it, getting them from Vancouver to New Hampshire. So that's just one of those player development challenges.
Yeah, player development challenges for fans, I'm sure, as well. With respect to that Vancouver Canadiens team, I could phrase this as maybe Tucker Tolman will join X, but those guys might get the bump up to New Hampshire after that. Look, Arjun Namala, you talked about it with Joe Sclafani. There's a little bit of, you know, what's the right timing? But Victor Arias and Cutter Coffey are a little older. They've been really, really solid throughout the entire season. Where are you on those two guys, and kind of what are you looking for from them for the remainder of their stay with Vancouver, which I imagine won't be terribly long?
keeping in mind that they're at high A, and the biggest jump in the minors is from high A to double A. Victor Arias looks like a big leaguer to me. Scouts have compared him, as I've told you before, to an NFL safety. He is a leadoff hitter who does not get cheated, but that's translated into leadoff extra base hits, leadoff home runs, and while we don't worry so much about batting order anymore, he sets the tone. And he certainly has so much for this really torrid stretch the season's been on. He sets the tone at the top of the order. He goes back on fly balls and makes them look so easy. He covers a great deal of ground in center fielder. If he can overcome a bit of a tendency to chase, because I expect double A pitchers are going to exploit that longer swing, and he will have to make corresponding adjustments. But he, to me, is a guy who will be in double A by next week. And we're looking at somebody I think who will be a big leaguer. Coffey, different story. Another guy who struggled when he first came over to the organization. And again, we have to keep in mind, as Joe said to me, you know, guys are leaving their friends. They've grown up in the organization. And it's really difficult to come to a new place, a new country, make adjustments with new philosophies. But Coffey is one of the toolsiest players in the organization. Now, we know that always doesn't translate into results, but I think we're finally starting to see them. And so there's going to have to be some movement. Some guys maybe have to be let go ahead of them, which is turning out to be kind of the normal process as we approach the this new draft date. But I expect Coffey maybe a little bit later, but he's going to be there as well. I think New Hampshire's going to have a different look to their infield in a couple of weeks' time.
I expect Coffey a little later, too. It's a long day for me. Ayo.
One more for you before we let you go really quickly here, Doug. But you mentioned patience levels and the Blue Jays trying to give Aurelvis Martinez as many chances as possible. Can you put your finger on what is not working for him right now?
This is a guy who's pressing. I mean, there's no secret. As Sclafani said to me, when opposing teams come to town and they see the lineup card or Aurelvis's name gets circled, at AAA, the scouting reports become much more detailed. The pregame meeting between the coaching staff and pitchers and catchers becomes a lot more detailed, and there's a much more focused plan of attack. Aurelvis showed an adjustment and ability 2 years ago to adjust to the fastballs on the inner half, on the spin on the outer half. Back into that pattern, though, and he just, for whatever reason, maybe trying to make up for lost time, maybe still kind of the stigma of the suspension last year, not sure exactly what it was, but he's really flailing at the plate, and he's back going to getting tied up on the inside stuff and flailing away and missing at pitches on the outer half, breaking stuff on the outer half. So he needs to somehow get back to that form that he was at even a year ago at this time and not chasing as much.
Yeah, it's tough. The stat line is not pretty, and he needs that because the defense is a little shaky as well. Doug, this was not shaky. This was very great. Appreciate the new background. Appreciate you taking time out this morning. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you guys very much. Enjoy the coffee.
Thanks. Doug Fox, it's the Future Blue Jays newsletter. You should already be getting it in your inbox whenever it comes out. But if you don't yet, make sure you go check that out. Doug's also on social medias at DMFox705. So mostly fun stuff there.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know, because we get asked about in the text line a lot about Aurelvis Martinez. When's he coming up? Where's the spot for him? He's hitting, and we're talking 63 games in the season now, .192, OBP down below 300. And even with the power that he has, just a .651 OPS. And again, the defense is not, you know, it's enough that he's been moved positions a couple times now. He's been getting some reps at first base to see if that can step. Not in game, but he's been taking some reps at first base. So a lot going on there. There was a hot streak for a couple weeks there where I was thinking, okay, maybe he's figured some stuff out. It's gone the other way. I believe it was a 1-for-29 stretch.
What?
That he was on at one point. So nothing, I will say nothing imminent there when it comes to Aurelvis Martinez. Not that the Blue Jays have an immediate need given the play of Ernie Clement and Addison Barger.
Yeah, the Blue Jays are pretty set.
Yeah, for now, but injuries happen and trades happen and things like that.
They do. My mind goes to the trade deadline, and maybe if this is...
Well, the thing is, if you're playing poorly, your value has gone down, right? Yeah, coming off of a PED suspension and then a terrible season so far, I don't...
It's not going to be huge value.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is sad, obviously, even from that lens. But I don't know. Maybe this, it just has run its course with this organization, you know?
I mean, he is still pretty young, though. Like, he's 23. He's only, I mean, I guess this is like his third turn at AAA, but they've all been like partial season turns. I'd imagine the suspension, like if we went back and looked at, like, that's got to be a big developmental hit, a huge, half year of no games and no steroids.
Tough.
sorry, I shouldn't
it's
say
tough.
That.
It's, you know, it's a problem for
yeah.
sure.
All right, tonight the Jays will get back in action. Max Scherzer returns, which is a lot of fun. And get this, he has seen the Guardians for 91 plate appearances. 52 of them have been Carlos Santana, and he has four hits. Four yep. for 52 with 14 strikeouts. If you were going to break the, if you were ever going to break the Carlos Santana is a Jays killer narrative, it's going to be against Max Scherzer. Yeah. Four for 52 with 14 Ks. Lane Thomas, Jose Ramirez, Austin Hedges all have poor sample against Max Scherzer. Obviously, some of that is going back a little bit, and Max Scherzer is a Hall of Famer. But, you know, that's always good to see. Gavin Williams on the other side comes in with a 3.58 ERA. The underlying metrics aren't that sharp, but he does throw 97, and he has three secondary pitches, so maybe not the easiest guy in the world to hit against. Bo Bichette has homered off of him in the past. Nathan Lucas has a couple walks against him. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., George Springer, both 2-for-6 with a double in the past. So we'll see how that one goes. A lot on line. The division's only 2.5 games away. Jays have a 2.5 game cushion over the Guardians. So pretty important one. You and Sho will be back tomorrow to break it down.
Yes.
I will not be because I now move to NBA draft coverage for a couple days. If you are a Raptors fan as well, I'll have a Raptors show tonight after Blair and Barker finish Jays talk to break down the first round of the NBA draft and the Raptors' number 9 pick. Thank you to Arden Zwelling, Paul Sporer, and Doug Fox for joining us today. Thanks to Ahmed Austin and Jennifer behind the glass. Have a wonderful Wednesday.